Let's start with some good news, I think, this week.
Yeah, some signs this week, Brett, that the, I guess what you could call a bit of a purple patch for agribusiness seems to be continuing, with some really positive signs around optimism for farmers. A survey found there's actually record levels of optimism, particularly among livestock producers. I mean, who wouldn't be optimistic when you're getting the sort of high prices that particularly beef and lamb producers are getting at the moment? They've had several good seasons, record exports, and those high prices. So the survey found that those producers in particular are intending to take on more staff. They're going to be investing in buying more equipment for their farms. And also there's a real interest around investing in new technology. So some real positivities there. Also, there's interest in the dairy industry is rebounding, perhaps you could say, from a pretty low base.
There, yes. Yeah.
So the survey found that dairy farmers were planning to expand their business. There'd been an increase, but as we said, from a low base. So 6 months ago, just 1% of dairy farmers said that they wanted to expand their business, and now that's up to 12%. So, you know, some signs that an industry in recovery there. So this came from a Commonwealth Bank survey. It was conducted in January and February. It did find there was less enthusiasm among grain farmers, crop farmers, and I guess that's understandable given the lower prices they've been getting this season. Grant Cairns is the head of agribusiness banking with the Commonwealth Bank, and he expects there'll be more job opportunities on farms.
15% of beef producers saying that they'll expand their enterprise, and 18% of wool producers and lamb producers saying that they'll expand their enterprises, which, you know, particularly for lamb producers, that was twice for the same time last year.
I imagine one of the other factors in this boost in optimism is that just the value of farmland is on the up as well, Kath.
Yeah, so we had some statistics this week around the value of farmland, and it's increased across much of Australia in the past year. And another interesting thing came out of this was we hear a lot, I guess, about foreign investors or big corporations buying up farmland, but this latest stats show that it's actually existing farming families who are expanding their farms, and they account for most of the people buying farmland in Australia. So there was a survey of 230,000 transactions. It found that median farmland values increased by 9.3%. So it's not just the inner city property prices that are booming in Australia at the moment. So that's a fairly significant rise. It was highest in the Northern Territory, where values went up a third. But it must be noted that that was based on a smaller number of sales that happened in the territory. The lowest was in Tassie. Values there actually dropped slightly. Andrew Smith is with Rural Bank, who did this survey, and he said the price rises really are still largely attributed by farmers buying up their neighbours' property.
We're seeing strong demand for signature properties, certainly some of the larger corporate-owned properties changing hands throughout that year, but in terms of the body of sales, many are to neighbours, and they tend to come with a bit of a premium due to the economies of that, but the majority, we would say, are family farm business sales.
And that kind of goes to the heart of what agriculture's been, I guess, in the best part of the last decade, where the number of farmers in Australia is dropping.
But that real consolidation.
The scale is getting a whole lot bigger. Mm. Speaking of investment, Chinese investment in Australian agriculture always gets people talking. Lots of theories floating around about finding the best mechanism when dealing with Australia and China.
Yeah, well, last year, just on, I guess, some stats around sales, 12 Australian agribusinesses were sold to Chinese investors in the past 12 months. But as well as those sales that went ahead, there were some really high profile rejections, including, of course, some Chinese bid for those Kidman cattle properties that garnered a lot of attention. Now, is this sort of hysteria around people opposed to foreign investment, or is there, you know, are the Chinese buyers going about it the wrong way? Now, a PR firm has looked into this, and it's got some advice for Chinese investors who want to buy into agribusiness in Australia. It says that they really need to win trust and respect in those communities that they want to sort of, you know, be partners in business in or buy business in if they want to go ahead with that investment. It's what's becoming known as a social license, which, you know,
it's always a term to go with everything.
There is, yes. And so this company, Pow Tate Australia, has produced a report looking into, you know, some of the failures and some of the things that companies should be doing. I guess one of the examples they used of what not to do was an example of a dairy business that was mooted for South Gippsland in Victoria. This was the Ningbo Group. They had a dairy called Yo-Yo Dairy, and they were going to do this massive project in the little rural town of Kernot, where they were going to put you know, thousands of cows in barns and bottle it there and send the milk off to China. They were even going to bring over workers from China. And it was one that just didn't sit well with the local community and was in fact rejected by the local council. Alistair Nicholas from Power Tate, who's looked into some of these examples, says that was really an approach that didn't go down well.
But then they started also making statements about bringing in Chinese workers because Australian labourers were too expensive and didn't work hard enough, etc. So they were sending out messages which were critical of the market they had come into, which, you know, if you came into China, you would never do that.
We'll come back to China in just a second, Kath, but stick with this dairy theme for the time being. And one story that's been kicking around is obviously the Murray Goulburn and what's been going on. That's been the best part of a year.
Mm.
But this isn't necessarily a story for farmers in this case. This is about what it means for regional communities when the processor shuts up.
Yeah, this is a real look at how the fallout sort of the trickle-down effect, I guess. And we've heard about Murray Goulburn's plans to now shut down some of its factories in rural Victoria and in Tasmania as well. Now, one little community in northeast Victoria, the small town of Kiewa, it's one of the ones that's been sort of flagged as a factory that will close. And it's going to be really significant because Kiewa has a population of less than 500 people and there's 135 jobs at that town. So you can just imagine the...
We're talking about a quarter of this town, more than a quarter.
And then, of course, you know, it's sort of probably everyone you know has a connection to that factory. So they've really started to mount a campaign to, you know, try and work out what they can do when Murray Goulburn leaves town. The mayor, Jenny O'Connor, she put together a town meeting that was held this week. And from that, they formed a group to lobby government. They'll take a number of questions about Murray Goulburn's plans to the company.
People don't want to see a dead factory sitting in the middle of their town. They don't want Murray Goulburn to mothball this. If they don't want to run a plant, okay, that's their decision. But, you know, just to shut the doors and leave a dead factory sitting in the middle of a town is not okay.
And one of the people that's sort of been personally affected by this is Robert Ramsdale. He's worked at the factory for 14 years and he was about to start building a house when he heard that he'd actually lost his job. He hopes that Murray Goulburn will reverse its decision and stay in the town, keep the factory open, because he says he never imagined that, you know, he'd lose that job and wouldn't be working at the factory.
No, I didn't, because I love the joint. Yeah, I love the area and I'm originally a city boy originally and... I've probably become a bit complacent, you know, but I love my job and, I enjoy what I do. I mean, I don't enjoy getting up 3 a.m, but, yeah, it's a good job.
One of the parts of this that I'd never thought about was even just the football team. The sponsorship that you get that flows on. So, you know, there might be an electrician who does work at the factory. It is so much bigger than just the 130-odd people that work there. It'll be interesting to see what happens. We were chatting about China just before, Kath, and for US farmers there's been some good news in terms of getting access into the Chinese market.
Yeah, an opportunity that's opened up for the US, but I guess for Australia we've sort of, they're muscling in on one of our...
another man's pain.
Exactly. Yeah. On one of our biggest markets, which is the market for beef exports. US officials this week negotiated a return of American beef to China, which is the world's largest market for beef. The US had been locked out of China since a case of mad cow disease back in 2003. And since that time, China's beef imports have grown to be worth $3 billion a year. And Australia, Brazil and Uruguay are the top suppliers there. So it's a really important and valuable market for us. We'll see what, you know, the US and whether they take a dent out of that for Australian exporters. Rabobank's analysis shows that Australia does have an edge with chilled, hormone-free beef and also processes we have in place around traceability of beef and over the animal's lifetime. Craig Uden is president of the US Cattlemen's Beef Association, and he hopes the US will begin exporting beef to China as early as August this year.
Well, you know, we have been locked out of the world's, what we think is the world's largest market for 13 years. And we are extremely happy from the announcement from the White House that we have reached agreement to restore U.S. beef exports to China.
It's one that's been closely watched, not just in the beef sector, but interestingly, from what some of the reading I saw, that part of the return agreement is that the Chinese get improved access or better access or assistance going into buying into the US. So a lot of that, the foreign investment, the debate in the US is much what we're seeing here in Australia.
And one issue that they're likely to face selling products into China is one that a lot of Australian producers have faced, which is this idea around counterfeiting. It's been a massive issue where Australian beef exporters, I know of one Victorian Wagyu exporter who had to introduce a special sort of identification for his product because it was just being counterfeited. Once something becomes popular in China, you have all these people popping up, sort of offering fake versions of that product. Now, an Australian group that sell olive oil into China have come up with a nifty little way around this. So they've introduced a scan label on the bottle of olive oil so that consumers in China will be able to verify its authenticity. It's an international marketing tool known as Australian Authentic, and it's designed to stop sort of inferior oil being passed off as being quality Australian olive oil product. The chair of this program is Chris Mercer, and he says these labels are made by a German company which manufactures those really high-tech banknotes, and he anticipates the approach will double the return for Australian olive growers selling product into China.
We also insist upon a QR code. What happens is, using a mobile phone, the user can scan this QR code either online before he buys it or when he joyfully receives it, and he can meet the guy who made it and learn about its provenance and who he's buying it from.
When we talk about trade all the time, we had a bit of a look into the numbers late last year and early this year, and the thing that we forgot about was just how much of a sleeping giant wool is. It's still the major driver of agricultural exports in Australia. China is what we talk about the most. But it's more than just China now that's interested.
And one of the really big markets is Japan. And of course, with exports, the foreign currency and exchange rates have so much impact on, you know, whether a product is attractive to another country. And that's been the case for Australian wool going into Japan in the past years. We've seen a combination of the Australian wool price ticking higher, but at the same time, the Japanese yen has been a bit weaker. So it's seen the cost of Australian wool being sold into Japan double in price just in the past since last year. So a massive jump. But that hasn't been enough to deter Japanese buyers. They're still really keen on getting their hands on Australian wool. Mike Kiritani is a wool broker. He works for Itochu, who's one of Japan's largest trading companies. He says there's a really strong appetite in Japan for high quality, fine micron wool that comes from Australia.
But the new market is coming up from sports apparel for socks and innerwear. So this new demand will create a new market now. So I don't think overall the demand on wool will be decreased for the next couple of years.
Let's come back home, Kath. And scientists are busy working, looking at plant diseases and the impact they can have here in Australia.
Yeah, this is a bit of a tongue twister, this one. You may not have heard of Xylella fastidiosa. It's also known as Pierce disease, and it's big news around the world. We don't yet have it in Australia, and scientists here are determined that we don't see it here. In the States, it's caused huge problems, but particularly for their grape, their vines, and also for wine grapes as well as fruit grapes. But its level of devastation can be massive. What I've read is that it actually sort of causes the trees to dehydrate. So they kind of, it sucks all the water out of them and they just die and there's nothing you can do about it. Now, why it's becoming such a big concern around the world is because it's now been found in Europe. It's been in the Americas for years, but it's now been found in Europe, in southern Italy, and it's devastating ancient olive groves there and also getting into vineyards, which is really sounding alarm bells. So scientists have been meeting in Australia this week for the first ever international symposium on dealing with this lethal plant disease and how we can keep it out of Australia. Dr. Kim Ripman is Chief Plant Protection Officer, and he says the exotic bacterium could severely hurt Australia's citrus, grape, olive, peach, plum, and even the forestry industry if it arrived here.
It's horrifying what we're seeing overseas. It just seems to have high genetic diversity, so it's evolving all the time. When it gets into a new environment, it behaves differently depending on the vectors, depending on the hosts and the climate environmental effects. It's a very difficult one.
Now, Kath, don't think I didn't notice how well you pronounced that disease there. I looked at when went the notes here and I wouldn't even know where to begin. Nuts.
Do you want me to do it again? Xylella fastidiosa.
Oh, my goodness. This is going to make my day. Nuts are the big thing in horticulture. They're making all the money. Some good news for walnut growers.
Yeah, this is a good story because farmers so often bemoan the weather. They blame the weather for everything.
It rains, they're happy. Doesn't rain, they're unhappy.
But here's a story about Australia's largest walnut producer, Webster Limited, which has just harvested its biggest ever crop in southern New South Wales. And it's attributing it to favourable weather conditions this past season. So yields across its orchards near Griffith are up by as much as 150%. But that's on last year's crop, which was severely heat stressed. Also, their Tasmanian walnuts have done really well this season. The company's Derek Goulet says, this season, Mother Nature has been cooperative and played along.
Quite a cold October, and as a result, the fruit set was amazing. We work on around 5 tonne a hectare, and we've certainly seen crops do nearly twice that. Been remarkable. So everything is full. We have a lot of walnuts in storage in our silos, but we have a lot of orders to get through too, so we're busily packing those out and getting those out into the market.
Normally when I hear talk of record crops, I hear a farmer complaining about the prices are pretty bad though as a result.
Not for the nut industry. There's so much demand.
Some good news. Kath Backlund, thank you.
Thanks, Brett.